as we look at all the names and titles of Jesus, we're finding all of these aspects about our Lord that maybe we don't fully understand or appreciate. We talked about how Jesus is the Messiah, the Christ, Emmanuel, you know, God is with us. We talked about how Jesus is the great physician. And we're going to talk about this morning how Jesus is our wonderful counselor. This is actually from a prophecy in Isaiah that Jesus he would be called Wonderful Counselor. And we're going to discover what this means. And really, there's more to it than I can even include in one lesson. But let's take a look at how Jesus is our Wonderful Counselor. You remember the old illustration of the man who fell into a pit and could not get himself out. And in that illustration, a Buddhist came along and said, "Your pit is only a state of mind," to the man in the pit. A Hindu came along and said, "This pit is there to make you a better person." A professor says, "If you would have listened to me, you would have never fallen into that pit." A subjective person came along and says, "I feel for you down there." An objective person said, "It's logical that someone would fall down there." A New Age person said, "You only think that you're in a pit." A Pharisee said, "Only bad people fall into a pit." Fundamentalist said, "You deserve your pit." A Calvinist said, "That was no accident. You were predestined to fall into that pit." A self-centered person said, "That's nothing. You should see my pit." A realist said, "Yep, that's a pit." And an idealist said, "The world shouldn't have pits." An optimist said, "Things could be worse." A pessimist said, "Things will get worse." And it's amazing when you think of all the different solutions that people have about the pit that we all found ourselves in. No one else really knew what to do, and yet Jesus, seeing the man caught in the pit, grabbed his hand and pulled him out. You see, Jesus is the wonderful counselor because he knows things about us no one else knows. He knows our greatest needs. He knows our greatest obstacles. He knows how to pull us out of the pit, and he actually went to the cross in order to do it. You see, nobody else did that for us. Now, there's going to be people who are going to come along. They're going to explain the pit. They're going to moralize about the pit. They're going to tell you how you deserved it and how it's going to make you a better person. And they have all their theories. Only Jesus can save us from the pit of despair. And so let's take a look at how Jesus is our wonderful counselor. It's actually from Isaiah 9:6, a prophecy about the Messiah. "For unto us a child is born, unto us a son is given, and the government will be upon his shoulder, and his name will be called Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Everlasting Father, Prince of Peace." Talking about Jesus. And when we look at this title, Wonderful Counselor, the Hebrew word here translated wonderful is, this word indicates a phenomena lying outside the realm of human explanation, that which is separated from the normal course of events. So that word wonder, you've seen it in the New Testament, signs and wonders, talking about miracles. So that word wonder is something that we've kind of lost, the wonder. We tend to have everything explained, and so we lose the sense of wonder, like maybe that you had when you were lying on your back in the grass at night when you were a kid and you were looking up at the stars. Remember that sense of wonder? It's the realization that there's something far beyond our comprehension. And so that's what this word carries. It's the same word used in Psalms 139:6. "Such knowledge is too wonderful for me. It is high, I cannot attain it." Remember that beautiful psalm about how God knows everything about me? He knew me before I was born. He knows what I'm going to say before I say it. He says, this knowledge was too wonderful for me. It is just beyond my comprehension. That's the word wonder. So it describes something incredible and unimaginable. And then counselor, in the Old Testament, this word counselor is used of leaders or advisors like Daniel or King Solomon, wise men, people who could counsel or advise with wisdom. So you remember Daniel's wisdom was so incredible that he was made second in command of all of Babylon. And then Solomon's wisdom was so well known that leaders would come from around the world to hear his wisdom and to ask him questions. But remember, where did their wisdom come from? It came from God. Daniel's wisdom was given to him by God. Solomon's wisdom was given to him by God. And so we read in Isaiah 28:29, this also comes from the Lord of hosts, who is wonderful in counsel and excellent in guidance. Now imagine when Jesus began to teach, a greater than Solomon. Do you remember the reaction of the people? They were astonished. They were astonished at Jesus' teaching because of Christ, in whom are hidden all the treasures of wisdom and knowledge, Paul writes. So we're talking about Christ having greater wisdom and knowledge than anyone ever alive because of who Jesus is. So this is our wonderful counselor. And so let's look at some, we're going to look at seven reasons why Jesus is our wonderful counselor. And in part, it's because of his love for our souls. Not all counselors love you. Okay? Jesus is different. Jesus is a wonderful counselor who actually loves you. We know this from this example here. This young man in Mark chapter 10. Now, as he was going out on the road, one came running, knelt before him, and asked him, "Good teacher, what shall I do that I may inherit eternal life?" So Jesus said to him, "Why do you call me good? No one is good but one, that is God. You know the commandments. Do not commit adultery, do not murder, do not steal, do not bear false witness, do not defraud, honor your father and your mother." And he answered and said to him, "Teacher, all these things I have kept from my youth." Then Jesus, looking at him, loved him and said to him, "One thing you lack." Jesus looks at this young man, and it says that Jesus looked at him and loved him. The thing about this word, this word agape, it means wanting what is best for that person. It's like not wanting any bad thing to happen to this person, wanting only what is good. And so Jesus looks at him, and with agape, he loves this young man. And you notice this young man, he's running and he's kneeling before Jesus. He's asking the most important question of all. You know, he's got the right question. He's going to the right person, Jesus. And it seems like Jesus is throwing a bucket of cold water on this young man. You know, what do you mean? Why are you calling me good? There's no one good but God. You know, and we wonder, Jesus knows this young man's heart. So he knows what this young man considers good. Maybe this young man thinks he's a good person. But Jesus doesn't want flattery. He wants him to stop and to think. Because this is a young man. We read from another gospel account, he's young. We read from this account that he's rich. And he's got his whole life ahead of him. And here's a beautiful opportunity for him to receive a pearl of great price. And so Jesus looks at him and loves him. Then Jesus, looking at him, loved him and said to him, "One thing you lack. Go your way, sell whatever you have and give to the poor, and you will have treasure in heaven. Come and take up the cross and follow me." But he was sad at this word and went away sorrowful, for he had great possessions. I want you to understand, this is not a gotcha moment. This is not Jesus trapping this young man. He looked at him and he loved him. He's sharing the truth with this young man. And agape, it's not an emotion. It's not love like we think of love, like an emotion or a feeling. It's a selfless desire to want what is best for this young man. So what would it profit a man if he gains the whole world and loses his own soul? And so naturally, Jesus is actually pointing out the one obstacle that this young man has. And that's what a good counselor does. Jesus has a love for our souls, but he also knows our deepest problems and our biggest obstacles. And that's what's happening here. Jesus looked at him, loved him, and said to him, "One thing you lack." Wouldn't that be great if it was only one thing that we lacked? That would be great. You know, this young man lacked one thing. "Go your way, sell whatever you have, and give to the poor, and you will have treasure in heaven. And come and take up the cross and follow me." But he was sad at this word and went away sorrowful, for he had great possessions. Of course, he was sad because Jesus had just put his finger on the one thing, the one obstacle. And that's what is so wonderful about Jesus, is he knows our heart. He knows our greatest need, but he knows our biggest obstacles. And so, for example, in Jewish thinking, money was a form of morality. That's kind of how they thought about it. I'm not saying every Jewish person thought this, but there was a predominant spirit of the age, we would call it, in which money was morality. Meaning that prosperity was a proof of good character, and because prosperity was a proof of God's blessing. So in other words, if you're prosperous, it just means that you're good because God's blessing you. And there are passages that would seem to indicate that from the Proverbs. But this young man was putting his faith in his money rather than in God. And so Jesus knows our obstacles. Being a good person can be an obstacle. Sometimes we look at somebody and we say, "Man, they're so close. They're such a good person. They could be a Christian." Being a good person is an obstacle. Okay? Because if you're a good person, why would you need to be a Christian? You're already a good person. Being an important person can be an obstacle. Trusting in money can be an obstacle. Or possessions more than God. How about holding a grudge? You think holding a grudge is an obstacle? I know you know the story about in Southeast Asia, somebody had come up with this ingenious way to trap monkeys alive and unharmed. And what they would do is they'd take a clay jar, a heavy clay jar, and it had a large bottom, but it came up to a narrow opening. And they would secure this jar in the ground so it couldn't move, or make it so heavy that it couldn't be pulled. And they'd drop a piece of fruit down inside the jar. And the monkey would come along and reach into the narrow opening of the jar and grab hold of the fruit. But holding on to the treat, they couldn't get their arm back out because their fist with the fruit would not come through the narrow opening of the jar. Now, the hunter would come in, and even as the hunter's approaching, the monkey would start freaking out, but would not let go of the fruit. And if they would just let go of the treat, they'd remove their hand and they could run. But they wouldn't let go. And so the hunter would just grab the monkey, alive and unharmed, because they would not let go of what they had grabbed down inside that jar. Now, how many people are trapped because they won't let go of something? You know, some people worry, and Jesus said, "Let it go." People hold grudges and they refuse to forgive, and Jesus says, "Let that go." But we're not going to let it go, are we? We're not going to let it go. Because what they did to me was wrong. They don't deserve my forgiveness. And so I'm not going to let it go. In fact, I'm going to remember it till I die, because that's some form of vigilance on my, some sort of vigilante justice on my part, as if that's going to change anything. And so what happens is we won't let go, and we become trapped. And in this case, this young man, he would not let go of his money. But that was just what his obstacle was. That's not everybody's obstacle. For some people, they won't let go of their grudges. They won't let go of their animosity. That, you see, it's different for every person. What is it that you won't let go and let God? And so, Jesus is our wonderful counselor, and so he knows our biggest obstacles. He knows what we need to let go in order to follow him. Also, Jesus, of course, knows our greatest need. He had gone through Samaria, and there was a woman there. We call her the woman at the well, the Samaritan woman. And Jesus is not going through Samaria by accident. You notice in his ministry, he goes to where he knows there's somebody searching. And this woman is searching. And so he goes to her and he asks for her for water. And she's puzzled because he's Jewish. She's Samaritan. He's a man. She's a woman. The two, you know, Jews don't even talk to Samaritans. So she's a little puzzled by Jesus asking for water. And Jesus answered and said to her, "If you knew the gift of God and who it is who says to you, 'Give me a drink,' you would have asked him, and he would have given you living water." The woman said to him, "Sir, you have nothing to draw with, and the well is deep. Where then do you get that living water?" Jesus answered and said to her, "Whoever drinks of this water will thirst again, but whoever drinks of the water that I shall give him will never thirst. But the water that I shall give him will become in him a fountain of water springing up into everlasting life." The woman said to him, "Sir, give me this water, that I may not thirst, nor come here to draw." Jesus said to her, "Go call your husband and come here." The woman answered and says, "I have no husband." Jesus said to her, "You have well said, 'I have no husband,' for you've had five husbands, and the one whom you are with now is not your husband. In that you truly spoke." Awkward. Do you see how Jesus gets down? He knows everything about us. He knows our greatest need. He knows our greatest obstacle. He knows where we're at in life. And regarding knowing our greatest need, Jesus knew her past. He knew her failed relationships. He knew her broken heart. He knew that she thought that men would give her fulfillment. Men would give her life meaning, right? Men would make her happy. And don't we think the same way today? Don't we think that if I get married, then we just live happily ever after? Isn't that what we were told? Isn't that the way it's supposed to work? And we would live happily ever after, and my spouse will be my everything, and my spouse will provide my everything, and give, you know, fulfill all my needs. Weren't we told that? Didn't we believe that? And then when a spouse fails to meet all their needs, whose fault is that? Oh, it's their fault. That's their fault. They were supposed to meet all my expectations. They were supposed to fulfill all my needs. And they failed. And now I'm mad. I'm bitter. Now I must have to go find someone else. Do you see? That's the bill of goods we were sold. But Jesus knew her greatest needs. And he knew everything about her. And when Jesus looks into our heart, he knows our greatest need is this living water. Whoever drinks of this water will thirst again. But whoever drinks of the water that I shall give him will never thirst. But the water that I shall give him will become in him a fountain of water springing up into everlasting life. We have a soul thirst, okay? And your bank account isn't going to fulfill that for you. And your spouse won't be able to fulfill that soul thirst. Now, they can help, obviously. But do you see, there is something, there's a greater need. There's something greater that our soul yearns for. Our soul yearns to be refreshed by living water. Our soul yearns to be forgiven of our shame and our guilt of our past. To have true peace and true love from God. And eternal love and eternal life with God. That's what our soul yearns for. That is our greatest need. And Jesus knows that. He knows what we need. There's also the fact that Jesus has empathy and compassion. He's our wonderful counselor. He loves us. He knows our greatest obstacles. He knows our greatest needs. He also has empathy and compassion. You remember in John 11, when his friend Lazarus died, then when Mary came there, Jesus was and saw him. She fell down at his feet, saying to him, "Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not have died." Therefore, when Jesus saw her weeping, and the Jews who came with her weeping, he groaned in the spirit and was troubled, and he said, "Where have you laid him?" They said to him, "Lord, come and see." Jesus wept. Jesus wept. Jesus wept when his friend Lazarus had died. And he wasn't weeping for himself. He's about to raise Lazarus from the dead. So why did Jesus weep? I think it's a good question. But when he sees the suffering and the mourning of those who had lost their loved one, and then he's moved with compassion, and he knows all that death carries and all that death has taken from us, going back to Cain killing Abel. And then he weeps over Jerusalem. We read again that Jesus wept when he looked over Jerusalem. He knew that their destruction was coming. He knew the suffering that they were going to face. And Jesus wept over Jerusalem. I feel like one of the deadliest lies that Satan makes people believe is that God doesn't care. That's a lie. Jesus wept. It's one of the most beautiful passages in all the Bible. Jesus wept with compassion for those who were grieving. He wept for those who were suffering. He wept over the lost souls of Jerusalem. And he went to the cross so that one day all the tears would be wiped away. God would wipe away all tears. There would be no more sorrow, no more crying, no more suffering. Jesus is the one who's going to make all things new because of it. He does have empathy and compassion. He is our wonderful counselor who also forgives our sins. This is in John chapter 8, and you know the account. It's the account of the woman who's been caught in adultery. It's in John chapter 8, beginning in verse 1, when Jesus went to the Mount of Olives. Now, early in the morning, he came again to the temple, and all the people came to him, and he sat down and taught them. Then the scribes and Pharisees brought to him a woman caught in adultery, and when they had set her in the midst, they said to him, "Teacher, this woman was caught in adultery in the very act. Now Moses, in the law, commanded us that such a one be stoned. But what do you say?" And look at verse 6. "This they said, testing him, that they might have something of which to accuse him." Okay? "But Jesus stooped down and wrote on the ground with his finger, as though he did not hear. So when they continued asking him, he raised himself up and said, 'He who is without sin among you, let him throw the stone at her first.' And again he stooped down and wrote on the ground. Then those who heard it, being convicted by their conscience, went out one by one, beginning with the oldest even to the last. And Jesus was left alone and the woman standing in the midst. When Jesus had raised himself up and saw no one but the woman, He said to her, "Woman, where are those accusers? Where are those accusers of yours? Has no one condemned you?" She said, "No one, Lord." And Jesus said to her, "Neither do I condemn you. Go and sin no more." There are so many questions that come up out of this text. One of which is, what was he writing on the ground? And we just don't know. But here's a woman who's been caught in the act of adultery, and from a legal standpoint, her accusers are correct. She is guilty. Okay? So we've got a legal case that's been brought to Jesus, and the question is, though, if this is really about justice, if this is really about the law, if this is really about justice, then where's the man? Why did they only bring the woman? Why didn't bring... If this is really about justice, where's the other guilty party? There's two guilty parties here, not just one. So, if this is really about justice, if this is really about right and wrong, why did they only bring the woman? But you see, this isn't really about justice, is it? We just read in verse 6, they said this testing him that they might have something of which to accuse him. Okay? So what they're doing is they think that they've impaled Jesus on the horns of an impossible dilemma. That's what this is about. Because if he says she's guilty, he's declaring her a death sentence. She's to be killed. But if he says she's not guilty, now he's breaking the law of Moses. So they think that they've caught him between the horns of a dilemma, inescapably. And so they're trying to set Jesus up. Now, would it be fair for this woman to be used for bait? Would she really receive justice if this was really just a trap to entrap Jesus? And would it be right for Jesus to use her, you know, as bait to get away from this dilemma? This is a fascinating passage. So Jesus has no choice, does he? Either he has to condemn her to death for the sin of adultery, or he's going to have to break the law of Moses. And so that's when he goes down and he starts writing on the ground. And we don't know what he writes. Some people wonder if he's writing names, naming names of the people who were there, you know. Some people wonder if he's writing the law, you know. Somehow, he says, when he says, "He that is without sin cast the first stone," then he stoops down on the ground and he starts writing again. Somehow, the men are slowly being convicted within their own conscience. And the oldest starts to walk away, and then the next, and then the next. And you just have to wonder how the conscience convicts. I mean, imagine if this woman is a young woman, let's say. And let's say one of these men are older in age. How many sins has he committed in the maybe 20 years longer he's been on earth than she's been on earth? I mean, we're all guilty of sin. And so their conscience being convicted, they begin to walk away. And then Jesus stands up and he says, "Woman, where are your accusers?" And they've already left. And so he says, "Then neither do I accuse you. Go and sin no more." Now, for the death penalty to take place, you had to have two or three witnesses. These accusers are now gone. And so, even from a legal standpoint, they can't even go forward with trying to bring charges against this woman. The accusers are now gone. But nevertheless, there's something Jesus knows. Jesus is not condoning her sin, but he's not going to condemn her, because Jesus did not come to condemn the world, but that the world through him would be saved. John 3:17. And so Jesus knows that he's going to the cross for the sins of the whole world, including this woman. And so what Jesus is saying is, go and sin no more. I'm going to the cross. And when I shed my blood for the sins of the world, you're going to be able to receive that grace. You're going to be able to be forgiven. You can have a new life. You can have a new chance, a new start. And so he says, go and sin no more. And he has given us grace. By the same blood that saves her is the same blood that saves us. We didn't deserve it. But that's what grace is. If it was justice, you get what you deserve. But that's not what grace is. Grace is you get what you don't deserve. You don't deserve grace. You deserve judgment. That's what you deserve. But Jesus took that upon himself on the cross so that you could receive what you didn't deserve. You will be able to receive grace. Because of Jesus is not condoning sin. He says, go and sin no more. But grace is forgiving sin. And he's giving us a new start and a new life and a new hope. And so, lastly, Jesus does know our past, but he also knows our potential. Not just with this woman. Think about Peter. You remember Peter? He boasted that he would not deny Jesus. But the Lord knew what was going to happen. Jesus knew how it was going to all go down. And the Lord said, Simon, Simon, indeed Satan has asked for you that he may sift you as wheat. But I have prayed for you that your faith should not fail. And when you have returned to me, strengthen your brethren. But he said to him, Lord, I'm ready to go with you both to prison and to death. Then he said, I tell you, Peter, the rooster shall not crow this day before you will deny me three times that you know me. Do you know what happens? Jesus says, he who denies me before men, him will I deny before my Father. Well, Peter just did that. Peter denied Jesus not once, not twice, three times. But see, did you notice that Jesus already knew that he was going to do that? He said, Simon, Simon, indeed Satan has asked to sift you, that asked for you that he may sift you as wheat, but I have prayed for you that your faith should not fail, and when you have returned to me, strengthen your brethren. Jesus already knew how it was going to go down. And what he was telling Peter is, you're going to deny me three times. And you're going to know it when the rooster crows. However, I prayed for you. And when you have got yourself together, and when you return to me, I want you to strengthen your brethren. So Jesus already knew this was going to happen. But he also knew Peter's potential. And so, after the resurrection, he goes to Peter personally. And Jesus is going to sort this out with Peter personally. And he said to him the third time, Simon, son of Jonah, do you love me? And Peter was grieved because he had asked the third time, do you love me? And he said to him, Lord, you know all things. You know that I love you. And Jesus said to him, feed my sheep. Do you understand? When Peter says, Lord, you know all things, that he knew that Jesus knew all things. Jesus told Peter he would deny him three times before he did it. Yes, he knows all things. He knows your past. Everything. He knows it all. I'm not going to pray to God, because if I pray to God, then I might say something that he doesn't know. I might, I'll try to avoid God, because then, my past might come up. He already knows all that. You're not hiding anything by avoiding him. He knows your past, but he also knows your potential. Just like Peter. And so it's so fascinating that Jesus went to Peter and asked Jesus, and asked Peter, not once, not twice, but three times, do you love me? Peter had denied Jesus three times. Now Jesus is confirming, do you love me, three times? feed my sheep, strengthen my brethren, follow me. And so Jesus helps us today. He knows our past. He knows your potential. He wants you to be saved. He wants you to be forgiven. He went to the cross to make it possible. He wants you to be set free and washed clean by the blood that he shed at the cross. And he gave you the truth to set you free. He is the wonderful counselor. And it has been said that truth is the fiery core of counseling. Truth is the fiery core of faith. You have to get down to the truth. And in terms of counseling, you got to get to the truth. Truth is the fiery core. And Jesus gives you the truth to set you free. This word counselor, it also carries with it advocate and mediator. Jesus is our advocate. He's our mediator. He helps us. He comforts us. That's another word that associated with the counselor. One who comes alongside you and helps you, guides you, counsels you, comforts you, acts as an advocate on your behalf. All of those are in that term, counselor. And what's so fascinating is that you can search the world over. You can search all the world's religions. You can search all the world's philosophies and ideologies. You're not going to find grace in any of them. There's no grace there. There's no grace in any man-made ideology. There's no grace even in the world's religions. There's only grace in one location, Jesus and what he did at the cross. That's the only place you can find grace. You can't find it anywhere else if we would just simply trust and obey. And if we can help in any way, please let it be known as we stand and sing.